Om Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We're continuing our reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 6th Canto, Chapter 4, the Hungsakuya Prayers. Today's text is 30. Yasmin Yato Yena Cha Yasya Yasmai Yad Yo Yata Kurute Karyate Cha Paravaresham Paramam Prak Prasiddham Tad Brahma Tad Tetur Ananyad Ekam Yasmin Yato Yena Chayasya Yasmai Yadyo Yata Kurute Karyate Cha Parabaresham Paramang Prak Prasiddham Tad Brahma Tad Tetur Ananyad Ekam Yasmin yato yena chayasya yasmai Yadyo yata kurute karyate cha Parabaresham paramang prak prasiddham Tad brahma tad hetur ananyarekam Yasmin yato yena chayasya yasmai Yadyo yata kurute karyate cha Parabaresham paramang prak prasiddham Tad brahma tad hetur ananyarekam Okay, we can do the synonyms. Yasmin, in whom? And then in parentheses, the Supreme Personality of Godhead or the Supreme Place of Repose. Yataha, from whom? And then in parentheses, everything emanates. Yena, by whom? Again in parentheses, everything is enacted. Cha, also. Yasya, to whom everything belongs. Yasmai, to whom everything is offered. Yat, which. Yaha, who. Yata, as. Kurute, executes. Karyate, is performed. Cha, also. Para avaresham of both in the material and spiritual existence. Paramam, the supreme. Prak, the origin. Prasiddham, well known to everyone. Tat, that. Brahma, the supreme Brahman. Tathetuhu, the cause of all causes. Ananyat, having no other cause. Ekam, one without a second. Srila Prabhupada's translation for this verse. The supreme Brahman, Krishna, is the ultimate resting place and source of everything. Everything is done by Him. Everything belongs to Him. And everything is offered to Him. He is the ultimate objective, and whether acting or causing others to act, He is the ultimate doer. There are many causes, high and low, but since He is the cause of all causes, He is well known as the Supreme Brahman who existed before all activities. He is one without a second and has no other cause. I therefore offer my respects unto Him. So, please repeat. The Supreme Brahman, Krishna, is the ultimate resting place and source of everything. Everything is done by Him. Everything belongs to Him. And everything is offered to Him. He is the ultimate objective. And whether acting or causing others to act, He is the ultimate doer. There are many causes, high and low. But since He is the cause of all causes, He is well known as the Supreme Brahman who existed before all activities. He is one without a second and has no other cause. I therefore offer my respects unto Him. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, is the original cause, as confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, Aham Sarvasya Prabhavaha. That's from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 10, text 8. Even this material world, which is conducted under the modes of material nature, is caused by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who therefore also has an intimate relationship with the material world. If the material world were not a part of His body, the Supreme Lord, the Supreme Cause, would be incomplete. Therefore we hear, Vasudeva Sarvamiti Samahatma Sudurlabha. If one knows that Vasudeva is the original cause of all causes, he becomes a perfect Mahatma. The Brahma Sanghita declares, Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchidananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govinda Sarva Karana Karnam. Krishna, who is known as Govinda, is the Supreme Controller. He has an eternal, blissful spiritual body. He is the origin of all. He has no other origin, for He is the prime cause of all causes. The Supreme Brahman, Tad Brahma, is the cause of all causes, but He has no cause. Anadir Adir Govinda, Sarva Karana Karna. Govinda, Krishna, is the original cause of all causes, but He has no cause for His appearance as Govinda. Govinda expands in multifarious forms, but nevertheless they are one. As confirmed by Madhvacharya, Ananyak sadrishabhavad eko rupajabedataha. Krishna has no cause nor any equal, and He is one because His various forms as Swangsha and Vibhinangsha are non-different from Himself. Om Gyanati Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Jaina Tasmaya Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishnam Stapitam Jaina Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vande Hang Shri Guru Shri Yutapada Kamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavangsha Shri Rupam Sagajatam Sahagana Raganathan Vitam Tang Sajivam Sadvaitam Sabadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhan Vitangsha He Krishna, Karuna Sindho, Dina Bandho, Jagatpate, Gopesha Gopika Kanta, Radha Kanta Namosate, Tapta Kanchana Gorangi, Radhe Vrindabaneshri, Rishabhanu Sute Devi Panamami Hari Priya, Vancha Kalpa Tarubhya Shah Kripa Sundumi Evacha, Patitanang Pavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Dittananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasari Gorbhakta Vrindha. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. When things get difficult, as they inevitably do in life, those who are pious tend to take shelter of God. Oh God, please help us. And those who are impious, it gives them more impetus to become more and more impious and demoniac, because they say, if there is a God, how can he allow this to happen? So many people to die, so much destruction. When things get really, really heavy, even those who are pious start to question, they start to wonder, is there really a God? How could he let this happen? You know, if you see some of these videos from the recent earthquake and tsunami in Japan, by the way, the word tsunami is a Japanese word because they've had so many of them. These devastating waves that follow earthquakes that are centered or near the ocean, they generally generate these devastating waves that come ashore. So when you see the videos of this destruction, literally within a minute, a whole village disappears. The water comes on shore, and 60 seconds later, all the homes and businesses, everything that was there, they're gone. So when you have such, and if you go back in the annals of history, this one is actually, in terms of human life lost, is really kind of small scale. There have been earthquakes in China that have killed almost 1 million people, 800,000 plus. So we start from there and you work your way down. So on the scale of, you know, human loss of life and because of earthquakes and tsunamis, this is actually minuscule. But it's just that this one has happened at a time in history where the technology was in place where we could actually see what happened. A lot of these earthquakes that happened in the past, you know, we hear anecdotally that, you know, so many people died, so many buildings were destroyed, but there's no real evidence, no photos, no. But now we have incontrovertible evidence, videos of the thing coming in, of the destruction, the earthquake, the aftermath, and the survivor stories are recorded for history. So when these kind of things happen, even the, you know, those who are pious and tend to take shelter of God in times of difficulties, they are shaken. Because the atheists pound them with these questions. If there is a God, and he's supposed to be all-powerful, omnipotent, how could he let this happen? That means he's not in control. That means he's not omnipotent. Or maybe there is no God after all. Like that. And those who are, you know, not well-schooled in the philosophy of the nature of God, in other words, sambandha gyan means knowing God's position and your own position. And if you don't know that thoroughly, you can be shaken when the atheists pound you with these kinds of arguments. So Daksha is showing here in his prayers that he knows Krishna's position. He knows what is God's position. And therefore he's going to the right source. In other words, I'm not just praying idly here. I'm not praying just out of some blind faith. I'm praying to that person that I know can answer my prayers, that I know has the potency to do what I'm asking. So Daksha is showing, by example, that when you pray to God, you better know who God is. It shouldn't be just on blind faith. Blind faith is discouraged on the path of Krishna consciousness. Our faith should be strong based on hearing from the Shastras, hearing from the Guru, and from personal experience, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita. That prakchakyashakamam dharmyam. You can experience yourself this path by following the recommended practices, the sadhana, engaging in the way that is recommended, then one gets direct experience, direct evidence of the existence of God, of the efficacy of this path that we're following. So, it is each and every one of us, it's our responsibility to come to this point that Daksha is at, where you know, factually, who is Krishna? And you can pray in the same way. Here, Daksha is saying, he's praying to Krishna. Now, Krishna obviously knows his position. He knows his position. He doesn't need Daksha to tell him that he's all-powerful and he's in control of everything and that he's the cause of all causes. He doesn't need Daksha to tell him this. So Daksha is telling him this to show that he knows, that he understands Krishna's position. So we actually have to get to this point also. And then we can, with heartfelt feelings, we can offer our respects to Krishna. This is the last line of Daksha's prayer. Therefore, offer my respects unto him. Why therefore? Therefore is there, that word is there, because he knows Krishna's position. He's the Supreme Brahman. He's the ultimate resting place and source of everything. Everything is done by him. So the atheist would say, Everything is done by him. So he's the one who did this. So why can't we blame him? No. He has made this arrangement, this material arrangement, because of our desire to turn away from him. Where are you going to go? Where are you going to go? If there was no material nature, there is free will to turn away from God. So by his causeless mercy, he has created this material world that we can go someplace to turn away from him, or apparently turn away from him. Because as Prabhupada states in his purport, this material nature is Krishna's energy. It's a part of his body. He says, if the material were not a part of his body, the Supreme Lord, the Supreme Cause, would be incomplete. So it is a part of Krishna, but he's designated this part of his energy for those recalcitrant souls who don't want to surrender, and we see that mentality in our society, in society at large. There's always a class of personalities who do not want to surrender, who do not want to follow the recommended path. Sometimes accidentally, like Dorkarani was telling me, she went to the marathon on Sunday, and it, one of those streets that was blocked off for the marathon, you weren't supposed to cross it. So she parked on one side, and she didn't really know that you're not supposed to cross. So she crossed to the other side to take some pictures. And when she wanted to go back to her car, the cop told her, no, you're not supposed to cross the street. So being an obedient citizen, she stood there in the rain and called for 2.5 hours. waiting to get back to the other side. So sometimes we inadvertently, go against the laws of nature or the laws of God or the laws of the state, and we have to pay the price. We have to pay the price. This is what happens. So we may not remember when we made that conscious decision to turn away from Krishna, but that's not the important thing right now. The important thing is we know that we're in a place of misery. Anybody who's not sleeping at the wheel knows that they're in a place of misery. This is not the place to seek ultimate happiness. It's just not going to happen. This is intelligence. It's not going to happen. I'm never going to make such a gorgeous arrangement of money and buildings to live in and people around me that I'm never going to feel any distress or unhappiness. And I'm going to continue this like that forever and ever. And it's not going to happen in this place. This is not the place for happily ever aftering. It is not. No matter what Disney tells us, it's not the place for happily ever aftering. You cannot live happily ever after here. It's not the arrangement. By God's arrangement, there's misery here, so we can come to our senses and ask questions. Why am I suffering? Who am I? What is this all meant for? What am I supposed to do with my life? As we know, we accept, because we know the soul survives the body, the soul survives the death experience. Many people have near-death experiences, NDEs they're called. And there are, some people in the scientific community who are, it happened too many times to ignore. So some people have taken to studying these. And one person who did such a study, she was actually a nurse in the UK, and she had seen so many of these people, having near-death experiences. So she did her thesis on this. And she was saying that one of the themes when they come back from this near-death experience is they say that while they were going through it, they were completely fearless. They just get, in other words, they went to the hospital, they had some fearful disease or something that was causing fear, but when they had that near-death experience coming out of the body, then they lost all fear. This is the real source of fearlessness, is to know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I am not this material body. Every single day we have some slight experience of that when we sleep, and like last night I had some vivid dreams, seeing people that I knew and stuff like that. Where is there any question of seeing when you're lying there with your eyes closed? So obviously the power to see, the ability to see, has nothing to do with this material body. It has nothing to do with the body. Similarly, all of our other senses, to hear, to experience, all of these things have nothing to do with this material body. This material body is compared to a vehicle. It's like a car that we're trapped in. And a lot of people got trapped in their cars in the tsunami when it came ashore. So you get trapped in a particular vehicle. You're the knower, you can see, you can hear, but you're trapped in the vehicle and practically there's nothing you can do. So we're trapped in these vehicles of this material body, and we totally foolishly identify with them, thinking that there are vehicles for happiness and they're going to last forever. Even though there's evidence to the contrary, my dear sir, my dear madam, that these cars, these vehicles that we're trapped in, they're not going to last forever. As a matter of fact, especially in this yuga, this age that we're living in, they're going to burn out after just a few decades. You know, those of us who are already in our 50s, approaching 60, we know. I mean, the best years of this body are behind the body, you know, behind us. Those years are gone. Those years are gone when you could run and jump and, you know, run around forever. You can't do that anymore all day long. The body just doesn't allow it. But we're not this body. So when one comes to the spiritual understanding, when one starts to experience one's real spiritual nature, then one is not bewildered anymore. One is not bewildered. Yes, the body will go through all these changes and the final change will be death, but we're not bewildered. We're not bewildered. Just like these people who go through these NDEs, near-death experiences, when they're going through it, they describe when they come back that I was completely fearless. There were some beings that I saw. There's usually a light somewhere that they are attracted to. And the overall overwhelming feeling is a feeling of fearlessness, of being free and happy. So if we want real freedom, if we want real happiness, we have to transcend this encaged situation that we're in. We are trapped in these bodies, these vehicles made of material energy, and we're experiencing unhappiness based on that encagement, based on that entrapment, just like people who were trapped in their cars in the tsunami, or even here in Southern California, many times flash floods and people get trapped in their cars. It's not a comfortable feeling. You cannot be happy in that situation. No matter if somebody came along and said, "Hey, here's a beer, here's a cigarette, or something, leave me, just get me out of here." You know, what are you, nuts or something? You're offering me all these things. I just want to get out. So it's the same thing. We're trapped in these material bodies, and it's nutty to just offer some material temporary relief. Here's something to eat, here's some clothes to wear, this is not going to solve the problem. The real problem is I'm unhappy because I'm encaged in this material body that's going to die. It's not me, it's not my natural position. I want to go back to my natural position of eternal happiness, ever increasing. So this is extremely important for us as sadhakas, as practitioners of bhakti yoga, to get to this point of completely understanding Krishna's position so we can give it to others. As Prabhupada was saying in his lecture on Sunday, he said this is the only business of the Krishna consciousness movement, is to teach people about Krishna. He said this is our only business. Our only business is to teach people. Why? He said, because if you learn about Krishna, then that is the ultimate success of life. And then again, Prabhupada asked why. Prabhupada always makes a proposition, then he questions that proposition so we can understand why the proposition is being made. So the proposition is that the ultimate success in life is to know Krishna. And then he asked why. And then he quoted that verse, Janma Karma Chame Divyam, Evam Yo Veti Tatvata. Because if you know Krishna in truth, then Taktva Deham Punarjanma. Then after this particular term of engagement in this particular body, then you go back to Krishna, if you know Krishna, in truth. Another reason why people lose faith in God is because, unfortunately, in many, many religious traditions, the leaders themselves, they're not imparting this knowledge of Krishna. They're not giving people concrete knowledge, even of the goal of life. Well, to speak of how to attain it. And therefore, people lose faith. I was reading an interview recently with Archbishop Timothy Dolan. He's the Archbishop now in New York, which is the second largest diocese after Los Angeles in the Catholic Church. And, you know, the Catholic Church has been rocked by a lot of sexual scandals, you know, priests preying on the flock like wolves. But beyond that, people are questioning even the relevance of the church anymore. He said, for the first time, he said when he was a boy, you know, once in a while you'd meet a Catholic who said, "I'm not a good Catholic, I'm not practicing," and you know, like that. But he said, nowadays you meet lots of people who say, "I don't want to practice anymore. Not just that I'm a bad Catholic, I don't want to practice. I'm leaving the church because it has no relevance in my life." So people are not seeing the relevance of spiritual organizations. Why? Because the leaders have made themselves irrelevant. If you look at this person, and I'm not picking on him alone necessarily, I mean, because this is there in every tradition. The guy is huge. He's a corpulent. So I was reading comments that people were making after the interview. You know, people were saying, this guy is obviously a glutton. He's a this or that. Look how fat he is. And it's not good. Prabhupada used to say that his spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, said that he did not want his disciples to get fat. He did not want that. You know, because if you're practicing spiritual discipline, you should have self-control. And it should be evident in your person. When somebody looks at you, they should see that, yes, this person is self-controlled. And if you're fat, then you're obviously not controlling your tongue. So this is the first thing a lot of people take this archbishop to task about. And then the guy drinks. Openly drinks. You know, he's in an interview somewhere and says, give me a cold beer. This is not good if you're leading, you know, a religious institution. It goes to the, I mean, I don't know where this came from. Those who grew up in the Catholic Church and tell me, but I mean, I grew up in the Baptist Church and Anglican churches, and intoxication was not encouraged. You were told, don't drink, don't smoke, don't all these things. It's surprising to me that the leader, an archbishop, can openly consume alcohol. To me, this is like shocking, even coming from a Christian background, what to speak of not being in Bhakti Yoga. And then, but the main reason, believe it or not, it's not that he eats too much or he drinks that people are upset about. They're upset because he's conservative about the core values of the church, like celibacy for priests. Because many people say if the priests weren't celibate, then you wouldn't have so much sex abuse going on by priests. And he says, no, I beg to differ. He says, in the world, if you look at statistics, the majority of sexual abuse is committed by married men. And he's probably right. I don't know the statistics, but that's what he says. And he's probably right. So it's not that because you have a license to have sex means that you won't, you know, abuse anybody else sexually. That's not the answer. It's not the answer necessarily just to get married. You have to have a change of heart. You have to have a change of heart. You have to see clearly what your goal in life is and how to attain it, how to achieve it. And focus your energies in that direction rather than focusing your energies on temporary titillation of the senses. So people are calling him irrelevant, calling the church irrelevant because they're sticking to these values, which we would agree with. Not, you know, that everybody has to be celibate. We know in the Vedic tradition, some priests are married and some remain celibate for life. So that option can be there. But it's not the answer that if the priests all get married, then there won't be any sex abuse. That's not the case necessarily. Then the other thing is homosexuality, homosexual marriage in particular. The Catholic Church, the conservatives within the church are against that. And we would also agree. He said that, you know, marriage is meant to be between a man and a woman forever in the eyes of God. And if you have some other sexual inclination, that's not supported by the institution of marriage. He said, don't change the definition of marriage, please. This is his request and his defense. Don't change the definition of marriage. So we would agree with that. Then the other thing people take him to task about is, you know, contraception, that the church is against that. And for all these reasons, these are the real heavy reasons why they think that he's irrelevant and the church is irrelevant, and they should change. Oh, the other main thing is to have women priests, that the Catholic Church, the conservatives are still against this. His argument is that in the time of Jesus, he was actually not against women. Obviously, he had women disciples. He had women when he was resurrected. There were practically all women there, except for, I think, John the Baptist. And then he had women who were following him while he was preaching. So he wasn't against women, but, you know, Archbishop Dolan's argument is that he never openly ordained any women to be preachers. He took male disciples to be preachers. Traditionally, in the Vedic culture, obviously, women are not prominent in that role of preachers, but there are some. And in deference to the situation in the West, Prabhupada did allow women to live in the ashrams. Traditionally, that was not done. But he cautioned that this unrestricted mingling of the sexes is just going to cause further bondage. So he cautioned, even though men and women are living in the temples and the ashrams of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, don't take that as a license for loose behavior. Prabhupada once told one of his servants that, yes, if you're in the kitchen with the Matajis, the only conversation is, where is the salt? Or like that. So we shouldn't take it as a license just because the International Society for Krishna Consciousness allows men and women to live practically under the same roof, that it's okay to just have loose relationships. No, that's not, because this is what's keeping us bound to this material world. We're already bewildered by our own bodies, thinking that I am this temporary bag of skin and bone and flesh and blood. And then we become, by too close association, bewildered by somebody else's body. even though it's practically exactly the same as yours. There's minor differences. The nose may be this way, the genital is different, but practically it's the same body. So in essence, you're being attracted to yourself. And we have this body, we know what this body's like, how much misery it produces, and still we're attracted to another miserable material body. And we will remain bewildered if we don't listen and imbibe thoroughly these points that are being made by those in knowledge, like Daksha here. Obviously, this demonstrating his knowledge of Krishna, Krishna's position, and therefore he's approaching Krishna, not idly, not whimsically, not on blind faith, but I know. It's just like if you approach Bill Gates. I know you're worth $50 billion. Can you please give me a few? You know, that's intelligent. To go around begging just any and everybody. If you're going to be a beggar, go to the, you know, somebody you know has a lot of money. Maybe you'll be successful there. So Daksha is showing, I know who you are, Krishna. I'm praying to you because I know your position. You can grant me. We'll stop here if there are any questions, comments on this verse and purport. Grantarashimi Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Thank you.